Please join me in welcoming our Aida Tamara Wilson, her daddy, Brian Mulligan, Ramfiz Morris Robinson, and I'm Asadur Santurian, and joining me will be Ed Berkeley and Robert Spano when they get here from their various sessions. So today we're going to talk a little bit about Aida, the opera, and a lot more about my very interesting guests who are thrilled to be here, just as you are thrilled to be here with us. In the case of Morris, he has several priors in Aspen. They've all been Verdi's, Verdi Requiem, yes. And our repeat offenders here, Brian is an alum and has been back several times as guest artist, most recently as Balstrode in Peter Grimes. And Tamara Wilson was our Fiordaligi back in 2007. And she is now left Mozart behind and has been tackling Verdi roles. And most recently, she made her Metropolitan Opera debut in this role this season. And it was wonderful then, and it's wonderful this week as we've been rehearsing it. There's a very special connection with this cast, and I think it's because I think everyone is very comfortable about being back home, I would say, and a terrific camaraderie. Not when we discuss their roles, however. There's real tension as characters on stage, so not to worry. Very quickly, just a few facts about this opera. You'll read all about it in our wonderful notes when you get the book. 1871, it saw its premiere in Cairo, commissioned for the opening of the Cairo Opera House, and then just a few months later, it received its European premiere in La Scala and has basically been on the repertory of major opera houses throughout the world ever since. It's a staple. It's grand opera without a single additional note. I mean, there's no excess to this except the excess that grand opera suggests. And then we'll get into that when Ed Berkeley gets here. But I wanted to talk a little bit about each of our singers today and have them talk about this role. And I think, Brian, you're coming to this role for the first time.
Yes.
Yes. Morris, you're not coming to your role for the first time.
No, I've done it a few times.
So. Okay.
And I feel
win.
Like I should talk really low.
Well, you can see the voice categories they sing. I don't have to introduce their voice categories. If you feel the earth move, it's Morris. If you feel the air changing, it's Brian. If you're feeling dizzy and altitudinal, it's Tamara. So let's start with the lady. So let's talk about the debut at the Metropolitan Opera and having it be this role. Let's talk about your psychology and approach, and then maybe a little bit about your experience.
Sure. I found out 2 months before my debut that I was offered the role of Aida. LaTanya Moore, who was scheduled to sing it, she was pregnant, so she had to gracefully bow out instead of having a child on stage, which was a wise choice, I do believe. So I was in Milwaukee doing a Don Giovanni. So I'm not done with Mozart quite yet.
Mozart, yeah. Wonderful.
The big ladies.
The big ladies.
And my manager texted me, and he knows that I don't like bad news. So he goes, call me back. Don't worry, it's good news. And I was like, okay. And then he said, your family's going to have Christmas in New York this year. I was like, what? And yeah, he called me. He goes, they want you to come and sing Aida. And my head instantly went like, and then after that excitement, I went, oh my goodness, I have to go do that now. And it's not like I was making my role debut as Clorinda in Cenerentola, you know, like an ugly stepsister. And it's just, you know, a little part. It's like Aida at Christmas with everybody in New York watching it. So I was kind of in a let's see, psychological place where Aida would be as well. A little terrified, a little excited. And the reason I said yes at such short notice is Aida was actually my most performed role so far. I had done it in Sydney first when I was 25, 26. And I'd done 10 performances there. And then I've sung it in Chile and Seville and Mallorca since then. So I was really comfortable with the role, and I had done a lot of production. So I knew it backwards and forwards, and I knew that wasn't going to be a problem. When I got to the Met, I only had 4 days rehearsal in the room. Then we had Christmas break, 2 days with the tenor. And then my debut was my first time with the orchestra, first time with set in costume. Yeah. And that one, I would not have done that had I not performed the role so much. So it was exhilarating and just, oh, so terrifying all at the same time.
Well, obviously, one of the Met scouts had seen you in performance of this role, because they don't cast anyone without...
That's true.
Yeah, so yeah. You had been spied upon prior to being given this wonderful invitation, and we're thrilled you're doing it here and with such an expert hand. Thank you. You may applaud. Okay, Morris, you can rev up the engine now. You met your debut in which role, and what's the most recent role you've sung at the Met, and what was going through your mind at that time?
My debut was Second Prisoner in Fidelio. I had like one sentence, and then my most recent role was Rondo in Trovatore, which I'm going back to do this year. Verdi, again, of course. With regards to Romphis, the very first time I ever did opera, the very first opera I ever attended, actually, was Aida, and I was singing The King and Aida. It was kind of a long story that has followed me around, but from singing The King, you're in a lot of scenes with Romphis, and he gets bigger and better stuff to sing, so my competitive juices immediately said, I want to sing that guy next. So I sang The King for years. I sang it at the Met lots of times, and I actually sang it in rehearsal this week when Matthew was not there. I sang both roles. But when presented with the opportunity to sing Romphis, I was excited about it. I'd anticipated it for a long time. And it's my favorite role to sing, just as the Verdi Requiem is my favorite bass role. So I've been able to sing them here, which I enjoy. Coming in early and dealing with the altitude and the lack of oxygen, you need to be very comfortable with what you're doing technically so that you can overcome these things. And I think that because I've been here before and I've learned how to navigate these things technically, I've been able to do a pretty good job for you guys. I'm looking forward to doing it also here. The character, if you want to talk about that, some
sure.
I guess, Romphis is the high priest, and I don't know what Verdi had with priests. Maybe you can say something more about that later, Ed, but every priest role I've played with Verdi, he's always controversial. I mean, it's true. I mean, Romphis literally has ticked off the whole opera. You know, his whole thing is, I don't really trust this guy, but I'm going to get him. He's going to have the job anyway. But I think I'm at least suspicious of the relationship he has with Aida, and I turn on him so quickly. You know, I eventually am the one to put him to death. So, you know, everything I say is angry and defiant, and it fits right into my bass voice. So it just kind of works out for me.
And you intone it quite well there.
Thank you.
Yes. You can hear him from any corner of the tent. Wherever Ed has him, you can hear him.
You can hear it here.
Yes.
Yes. Well.
But please come to the tent. Brian, let me ask you that question as well. What was your first essay at the Met? And go ahead.
Well, hi, everybody. I'm Brian. Okay, my debut at the Met was actually in 2003. I was still a student at Juilliard. It was a small role in Die Frau ohne Schatten, and it was thrilling. I made my debut, I think it was like 30 or 40 or 50 feet above the stage, because it's a spectacular production where the floor raises up. Anyway, I'm not explaining it well. So what else about Verdi you'd like to know?
Well, what are you doing more recently?
Oh!
And then you've got an exciting project coming up in...
Yeah. Well, this year at the Met, I'm doing my first Verdi role there. That's Paolo in Simon Boccanegra. Yeah. With Levine. That's fun.
Yes. Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And what are you doing in San Francisco?
Yes.
Oh. In San Francisco, I'm doing a bunch, but I just found out actually just a few weeks ago that the Sweeney Todd had withdrawn from the production, and so I'm Sweeney Todd. I start rehearsals. Thank you. In 4 or 5 days.
And what did you just do in San Francisco?
Oh, and I just did. This past year I sang my first major Verdi role, Renato in Un ballo in maschera. And I just did Troyan there with Runicles.
It was
a cool story.
Huh? With Brian.
With Brian Emel, yeah, who is also an alum here. Brian Emel, H-Y-M-E-L, was just on the cover of Opera News. he and I were students here in Aspen in 2004. I think we did Rigoletto together here. I was Rigoletto, he was the Duke, and this past year we were just now both in San Francisco singing together the Troyan with Runicles. So it was a happy reunion.
Well, tell us a little bit about your... I mean, this opera is about a love triangle gone really wrong and with very unfortunate consequences. But Ramphis has a role, Mr. Conflict, but you also have a role, and you're not part of this triangle. Tell us a little bit about your... Ed wants to say something. No. Okay.
It just amuses me that we're racially so confused in this opera that it's a breakthrough for this opera. It couldn't be the first time, Mars. I mean, do you think?
What?
Where the Egyptians versus the Ethiopians have gotten so confused.
And the color barrier being the opposite?
Yeah. Yeah. It's really deep.
Well, I've always been the Egypt on the Egypt side, so.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably Shirley Verrett sing Amneris, right? Who are other famous black Amnerises?
I've never sung with a black Amneris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because it's the piece is it's the Ethiopians versus the Egyptians, which is already confused. And so that then in this, Morris is Ramphis, and so he's pure Egyptian.
Correct.
And Brian is pure Ethiopian.
The Ethiopian king.
He's the king of Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Actually. But it's
you're
a
Mr.
Secret.
Ethiopian.
Well, it's a secret, so you shouldn't know it until the third act. But
this story is so universal.
Really?
It could be, yeah. Could be any group of people that are opposition to each other.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to. I mean, it's in the score that it's Egypt,
but then
the storyline doesn't rely on
the country
being Egyptian. Or
well, it's not Egyptian music either, so yeah. It doesn't really matter. Well,
except for the dances.
Yeah. Let's leave that alone for now. But Brian, tell us because your character introduces as though there wasn't enough tension between the love triangle, suddenly you appear in rather a very noisy scene. And
yes.
And like Paris, you throw the golden apple into the temple and all things break loose. So
yeah. Well, it's kind of like the greater... my character comes in and kind of introduces the greater kind of story behind this love triangle, all the political things that are going on behind the scenes, which kind of explains why Aida is enslaved and why she's captured, and then I come in and I'm captured. Basically, you know, I come in a captured person and say to my daughter, you know, you are in a unique position here because the captain of the guards who leads all the Egyptians totally has the hots for you. You can work your womanly wiles, and we are going to totally...
win the war.
And we're going to win the war.
Thanks, Dad.
No pressure.
Do you think that's why she left? Because of him? Because he's such a SOB. Do you think that's why she left?
No, no,
or
no,
she
no.
was just captured?
I think there's a... the reason she does actually betray Radames is because she does love her father.
Yeah.
And in some respects, when the messenger says, you know, the Ethiopians have beat us, let's go get them, kind of a thing, she's hopeful that he's coming to save her.
Right.
That's her first hope. And she'll deal with the whole boyfriend thing later.
I never know if it's love of country or father.
I think
that's the tear between
the
whole opera is about.
Yeah.
Everyone's familiar with the plot, right? And if you're not, you'll catch on.
Most people aren't.
Oh, sorry, guys.
No, no. I think everyone is fine with the plot. Let's talk a little bit about Aida and her psychology. What's going on through your character's mind when this other princess, you being an enslaved princess, is pushing you around and, you know, trying to draw certain information out of you? And how do you react to her, and what things do you have to remind yourself of so that you don't wound her suddenly with the nearest object?
Yeah. It's very interesting because Amneris is somewhat always played as evil from the get-go, but I don't think she's that way. I think she's manipulative, and she definitely wants what she wants. It's this thing about, this pervading thing about power. Every character has a want of power. He wants all the power.
I think that Amneris is an entitled, spoiled brat. You know,
I mean,
that's just how I feel. You know?
Yeah.
Well, who also manipulates her
dad? You've never sung Amneris, right?
What's that?
You've never sung Amneris?
No, I've never sung Amneris. I've done her father before, but yeah.
But Aida becomes captured, and she has to push down all of her royalty and her bearing and her own intelligence, because she's not an idiot. And I feel like while she's there, she's kind of spying on the Egyptians for her father so that when he does come save her, she can help with the cause, as it were. But then, you know, she meets this guy, and he's dreamy, and it's totally a West Side Story thing where, you know, I'm a jet, he's a shark, and it's not, you know. But probably the other way around. But anyway, he's very persuasive that, and naive, that our love can transcend everything. And once he comes in, I'm like, oh, I'm in a very tough position here. I love my dad, and I want to, you know, do what my dad says, but I also love this man, but I've only known him, you know, for 6 months, and I'm a slave, and I can't really have a life with him. I know in the back of my head everything is doomed, no matter what happens. So my character basically, in the third act, comes to terms with, well, I know I'm going to die no matter what happens. And at the very end, she decides to pick love in a very tragic way. But it's also a very happy and ecstatic way, because they're finally together without the outside pressures of these people. They're just together and in love, you know.
Okay, now let's put what you said in context musically.
Okay.
Your first appearance is when?
The trio, the opening trio. It's so funny. Verdi is amazing. He brings you a love triangle right at the very beginning, and it's a literal triangle in staging. So it's perfect. Yeah.
Okay. And what is being said at that point? Nothing to each other?
It's
asides?
Yeah, it's mostly asides, where I'm talking about why... am I really in love with this guy? But I really miss my homeland. And then Amneris is talking about who is this girl and why is he looking at her? She's a slave. Step off. And he's going, you know, oh, I'm all excited. I get to be, you know, head of the army, and I'm going to be amazing. And he's very self-centered, actually.
Well, he gets the first aria.
That's true.
Ed, do you want to add?
I was just going to say one of the cool things in this opera is that the prima donna of the opera enters and spends about 5 minutes silent, which is an unusual structure, so that you actually see her and you see the way people react to her more than she speaks for herself for quite some time. And it's a very interesting approach to as a way to develop a character, because you're aware of this sort of imposed silence on being a slave and being trapped here and therefore she has to be silent until she's essentially given permission by going to asides.
Right.
She's given permission to finally speak for herself.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty wonderful structure, actually.
It's a long way to her first aria, though, because the next episode is a duet after the trio with Amneris, where she is basically cross-examining you after that first scene. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and then when you do get to the Ritorno Vincitore, I mean, when you get there, then you feel like you really have fully met the character when she's alone on stage.
Right. You see the inner princess and inner warrior that she is.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what is Ritorno Vincitore? What is Ritorno Vincitore? Because that's what everyone is saying about their Egyptian commander and about the war against the Ethiopians, and you're singing it.
Yeah,
but what does it mean
say,
to you?
They say return victorious, return victor. And at the end, I'm so swept up in it because I love him, and this appointment in the military is his dream, and I know it's his dream, so I'm somewhat excited for him, and at the end I go, yes, return victorious, and I'm like, what? You're going to kill my people. So then that whole aria is about the dichotomy between loving my father and my homeland and him and how I'm going to wrestle that. And basically, I just, at the end of the aria, I get really angry. And then at the end, I give up and I say, God's really just help me, you know. And she leaves a lot up to fate.
At that point, you've seen Daddy. Because he's been brought in with the prisoners.
Back.
He hasn't shown up yet.
No.
She doesn't know that he's been captured.
Not until Radames comes back.
Oh, it comes right out. Oh,
no, right after
the triumph scene is when,
yeah.
I
when he
see.
Comes back. Yeah.
Okay. So then you cite Daddy. There's stuff going on through your mind, but he's quite clear with his instruction to you.
Yeah, he says, you know, don't tell people who I am.
Don't betray me. Yeah, don't betray me.
Because he's going to look like a king anyway. So.
Right, exactly.
I think that Amenazaro is really one of the most manipulative and tricky characters of the whole thing. I'm not to speak for you yourself, Brian, but just when he comes in captured, he has to downplay who he is. And then he plays on the conscience of the king and says, look, you're victorious today, but tomorrow it could very well be you going through the same thing that we're going through, so please have mercy. At the same time, he's plotting in his mind how he can utilize her relationship to get back at him. So he has to be really, really cool at that moment, because at any moment the king can say, off with his head, and he's over. So he has these survival instincts, you know, and able to think through this whole process.
And yet he's free range enough to find his daughter in the castle. Somehow he's been allowed to roam. And then you have your encounter. Let's get your point of view of that encounter, because you're manipulating.
Right.
And what are you saying? What are you saying to
me? Well, the first thing, she sees me in the crowd and says, it's my dad, and runs to me. And my first thing to say to her, kind of in a hushed voice, is, don't say anything. I'm not, you know, and then she's kind of like, okay, you know, I'm downplaying the, I tell this story to the king and to the court that I saw that the king himself was brought down in battle before me, and that our side is, you know, all in chaos, and that they won the battle, you know, but that again, like tomorrow, the tables could be turned. It's, you know, for me in that humongous scene, Amenazaro is doing a lot of observing and calculating and trying to, like, ascertain, like, okay, who are the players here? You know, I have to assume this is the first time he's seeing any of these other characters except his daughter. He kind of takes advantage of the fact that it's this humongous scene and there's all these people there to kind of, you know, step back into the group, you know.
And during that whole time, all I'm saying to the king is, kill them.
Yeah.
Kill them all. I'm the priest now. I'm the high priest. But I'm saying, kill them. Off their heads. If we let them live, if you listen to this garbage that he's saying, they're going to come back and fight us harder and harder again, and we're going to eventually lose. So the whole while, I'm saying, e morte. I'm just, you know, me and all my priest guys are just trying to get them all killed and get it over with. So
I have a question. You have people waiting outside the city.
Mm-hmm.
Did Amenazaro get captured on purpose?
That's something.
I was wondering.
Yeah.
Welcome, Robert Spano. Please join us. Welcome. We're going through the plot line, but we're putting it in musical context. So
to answer Tammy's question, hello, Maestro. In this particular production, which is my first production, I'm playing it as though he actually did allow himself to get captured, because the kind of the gossip that's gone beyond the walls of the, where they are, is that Aida, there is something between Aida and Radames. And so he's kind of like throwing a Hail Mary here to say, like, I know I can get my daughter to get this guy to give us the intel, and then my army can attack their army.
It's a lot of intel.
It's a lot of intel. But she's a powerful lady. That's why it's named Aida.
What comes next, Ed?
And where?
After Daddy.
Radames shows up and ruins everything.
Okay. Yeah. then we have, you have your duet with Radames, and at the end of that, you've been given instructions by Daddy to get...
to get intel about which path they're going to take their army so that they can ambush them. So at the end of our duet, I basically manipulate Radames to be like, hey, let's just leave. Let's forget everything and just go to a new country. That'll work. At the very end, I realize, oh, my dad's still watching us, so I have to do this. And I go, which path are you guys going to take? And he says it. And then he comes in and is like,
not the time.
Except singing.
Verdi wrote it that way, basically.
You've been spying all of this.
This is just my opinion. Nothing happens at that level of government that all aren't aware of. You know, I mean, this is not really that big of a secret that my captain is secretively, kicking it with the slave chick on the side.
I see.
So we all are aware of this. So he has intel, we have intel. You're playing on our turf. So when this whole clandestine meeting happens and he walks out and goes, aha, and they're all there discussing, and Radames is going, oh my God, I've betrayed my country. And then he's being more manipulative by saying, think of it this way, love conquers all, and whatever you're saying at that point.
Literally saying, calm down.
And then the nightmare takes place. I walk in and catch him.
Well, at the end of that scene, everyone's fate is basically known. Everyone's fate is sealed, because Ramphis and Amneris burst in, and that's it. That's the passport to death sentence.
It's a wrap.
It's also very cool, because I think Aida's behavior in the scene is not modeled, but influenced by what she's seen in Amneris' behavior. Mm-hmm. And so she's learned manipulation while she's been here. I know that she started out quite so manipulative, but now she knows how to do it. I mean, she sees Amneris' behavior.
I think had I not shown up, Radames and Amneris might have gotten together. It would have been logical. Had a military and the princess. It made sense. But I saw how she treated him and how he would react to her. And I go, okay, well, I can do this to him too, and maybe it'll work. Which is I'm a horrible girlfriend, but
eh. Oh, and it does.
And Amneris is not here to speak for herself, but Ed, why don't you fill in? She is contrite in the judgment scene. What's wrong with her?
I think she is contrite. I think something that's interesting in the character, which gets you through the first half of the fourth act, is that Amneris is aware that what she's done, I mean, she has no future, essentially, now. And so as much as Aida and, not to give it away, but as much as Aida and Radames are done, so is Amneris done.
Well, I mean,
and that
she's
really destroyed herself by her behavior.
Yeah.
And I think it winds up being a tragedy for her as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons we chose this piece is dreams of travel and exotica of Egypt and so on and so forth. And certainly Verdi did write this, not having ever visited Egypt. And there are these musical curly cues.
They're trumpets, right? They're going to be Egyptian trumpets. That's what I keep hearing.
That's
Someone's
it.
Promised
but
me Egyptian trumpets.
Let's turn to our maestro and ask him about preparing something like this and the superstructure, knowing the plot, but musically, how does Verdi support this? How does he weight the scenes? How does he propel the scenes? What's the kinetic energy? And sometimes in the most static scenes, there's the greatest tension. So can you comment, and then you can ignore my question and answer any way you want anyway.
Well, I think you allude to one of the most interesting things, which is this imaginary Egyptian music, which is wonderful. I mean, he's very believable, but it's his Egyptian music and not Egypt's. And but it's absolutely, it's the same way Mozart would write Turkish music. So it's
and
actually
Puccini would write Oriental music repeatedly.
So there's a real delight in his having created a musical language which does speak to our imaginations about the exoticism of the Nile. And I also think that the people who say that the libretto is flat or cardboard or not fleshed out or not... I think in conjunction with the music, we get a very complete picture of what's going on in these psyches, in these interactions, in these relationships. And I think that Aida's reputation as a spectacle show is taken care of in Act Two, but the real heart of the show is in the depth of interaction of these characters and how this drama unfolds and the intimacy of many of the scenes, which I think Verdi also captures. For example, what's leaping to mind is the intimacy of the accompaniment for O Patria Mia. To have three instruments playing along with the voice is not quite what we think of immediately when we say Aida, but it's very much at the center and heart of the work.
Well, thank you. Ed,
That was a very good dodge, I must say.
Yes.
It was really good.
What did
yes.
I dodge?
Yeah. Well, he had license to ignore my question. So, Ed, let's talk a little bit about your role in this as the circus ringleader, keeping us very much aware of the intimacy and the personal psychologies, because all these characters, when they sing alone, they're actually singing about what's going on in their own minds, except for him. He's just saying it the way he feels it. But
what's interesting, like with Rumphus, is that he has, because of the prayer sections, he actually does have sections that feel more private, that are less, I'm going to kill you any second.
So there.
Yeah.
That is the one moment, I think. But that's my job, you know. I'm going to bless this whole occasion and make sure that this guy comes back victorious, you know.
Well, and that's where you get to see what the way he functions as a public figure,
correct,
a high priest.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, talk about, you know, setting the scenes, and they move very quickly from intimate to public to grand, and then back down immediately after to, again, small, intimate psychogram moment of Aida's mental state of being to... tell us how you manage that and what you've got in mind for us.
So one of the things that's hard working in the tent here that's great and a challenge every time is finding the way to visualize a piece like this, because something I decided was that because the tent itself is a spectacle, I felt as though the more personal side of the story was the harder part to bring to visual life. So I made the choice of cutting the space and cutting a relatively small piece of the space out where all of the more intimate action could happen. And so that the feeling of how important the privacy was would really be visually reinforced. Instead of reinforcing, and truthfully, there will not be elephants, but instead of reinforcing the elephantine side of the piece, really to reinforce the private side of it. And so we have an object thing which contains the space, and it actually limits the space. And I think when you all see it, which I assume everyone will be there, when you all see it, it's initially startling, and then as the sun is setting and lighting takes over in the space, I think you're going to feel that the personal story of what the characters are going through really takes over in the opera, and as definitely in 3 and 4. it's become a completely private opera, completely private. And also that he starts the opera with a very simple pass-through of two characters in the midst of conversation, and again, and that immediately goes into a great tenor aria, so that it's a very private, the piece begins in privacy.
I think to your point and to your question, and I'm not you guys, but I think that what I do like about Aida and the way it propels itself is there's intimacy, and then there's big extravaganza. And after that big scene happens, it goes back to focus on who it affects individually, and you get to see the psyche of that person, and then it turns into another big scene, and then it goes to the next person and how it affects them. So after Rodimus is awarded captain, she has a moment of, oh, my God. And then it turns into another big scene where the triumphal scene becomes victorious, and then it turns into another reflective moment. Then there's the consecration scene. Well, there's he gets busted. They all get busted. And then you see Omneris go into her little window. And she's so it's very well organized that every section has an explanation with an answer to how it affects the characters involved. And I think that helps with the flow of the story all the way to the very end.
Did you want to say something?
I concur.
Go ahead.
That's it. That's all I was going to say.
Me? Oh, hi. I kind of in talking about the intimacy of the piece. You know, it's my Amin Azra. It's like I'm kind of accustomed to playing, villains, and a lot of Verdi baritones are villainous, and certainly Amin Azra is manipulative. But for me, like the best part of this character is the heart, and there's this true like patriotism and love of country, and that's really, you know, what's driving him.
None of the characters are wrong in their motives.
No.
They're all pure motives.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about Amneris.
I mean, well, she's, you know, she wants her man.
Amneris loves him.
Yeah, but, you know, she just wants possession. I mean,
yeah.
I think Aida actually loves him. I'm not sure. I think Amneris wants a toy, and he happens to be a tenor. But it's. I'm not sure that she really loves him.
I think that every last one of us is right in their own mind. And I mean, I'm just being a patriot, too. I'm trying to protect Egypt.
Isn't that everybody in real life? Everybody is their own leading person in their own movie. Yeah. You know?
But it's just hard to determine who's good and bad. Because when we walked in today, who's that? You said,
yesterday.
Here comes the bad people. Well, I'm not necessarily bad.
Evil.
Egyptians think he's great. Let's talk about the musical Collateral for a minute, Robert. It's 1870. Verdi will live another 30 years, but will not write more than three more operas. And his musical language at this point in his life is extremely sophisticated. Scenes will go from one into another. It does allow us to applaud, but there really is a real thought given to creating one large swath at this point, rather than some of his earlier operas where the aria properly ends and we applaud and something new starts. And he does imagine some local color, whether it's the oboes, solos in her arias, whether it's the high priestess with her prayer, whether it's this gentleman in his prayer. This is far more symphonic Verdi than, let's say, Rigoletto and Trovatore and Traviata. This is where the symphony is a character. The orchestra is a character. And they're not only helping you paint the scene, but they're also commenting. Can you talk about those moments where the orchestra is actually commenting and maybe what the orchestration might be we should look for? Do you want to reveal that to us?
Well, I think you said all of that so beautifully. Because, in a sense, the way I understood what you were saying is that we're well on the way to Otello here. Even if there is this long time gap, there's not a musical gap in his development, so to speak. So we're already into a very sophisticated vocabulary and a very sophisticated and informative use of the orchestra. And even in a way, it's not Wagner at all, but similarly does function as revealing the drama, the psychology, the mood. It is another character. I think what you said is so beautiful. That's really...
I was hoping to put it in the form of question and get more out of you. But Ed, is it
fun on stage when the band is there and the singers are there and, I mean, all of that juggling? That's a serious question, actually.
Is it fun versus you guys on stage versus a pit?
Versus a pit structure. I mean, I never know. I mean, when we do these semi-stage things, there's this physical structure.
Problem. Yeah, I think the experience, for me, it's very hard to say because the thing in the pit is a very easy, normal kind of relationship with the stage. It just feels normal. Getting into these kinds of situations where the orchestra's on stage always makes me feel that I'm in an abnormal situation. But I believe in these kinds of productions for what I've experienced as an audience member. I know how differently one can experience an opera firsthand by having it presented in this way, which I think, despite what I consider to be the beauty and power of the production itself, which I think is real and there's still a different focus on the music that comes out of this experience, a different level of attention to the detail of the music. And despite the fact of the beautiful production we have, that somehow... in the theater, sometimes that becomes the focus. Just the fact that people will applaud a set in an opera house, and there's a different level of focus. And I love the close up on the music that happens in this kind of presentation.
I think it changes for us too as singers. It's very easy to have a monitor or have an idea of the baseline of your music to follow. And everything's under your feet, and you're singing out to the audience because all the focus is here. But now, all of a sudden, the oboe's right behind me, or the trombone section's right behind me, and I'm very, very cognizant of that happening. And I have more insight, knowledge, and appreciation for what's happening with them as well. So I think it's just the collaborative effort from a musical standpoint is much more pronounced in this type of environment.
Can I say something?
Yes, of course.
I find that when you do a semi-stage concert opera, you get more of the soul of the performers. Because when we're in a production normally, we're in costume, we're kind of safe, we're away from you guys a little bit. When we're in a concert situation, we're right up there with you, and it's much more of a inviting artist and audience kind of a vibe, which I really enjoy. I love doing concert operas, actually.
It was funny because, last night there was a moment when you came off the bridge, and I'm sure it was Patria Mia, and you stopped in a place where David, the concertmaster, was just going into something, and I swear you were 3 feet away from him, and you parked so that your spotlight was going straight into his eyes.
Awesome.
But, yeah. But, but at that moment, it felt like we were in a chamber piece because it's so private then suddenly. And so musically, it was like it felt much more connected than most of the times when you see this opera. It's like they're there and you're there. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, it was really much more about one. It's the same thing on the bridge when you were up there with Amneris. It's like the two of you are there and Bob is right there within 3 or 4 feet of you.
Well,
which is a little scary.
I'm going to say something different, though, in that for our students, it really has the excitement of getting ready for the Super Bowl. Yes, because we have the luxury here of having these instrumentalists in the bandas are fully flushed out, so multiple bandas, and the fact that trumpet players are going around saying, I'm going to be in the opera, I'm going to be in the banda, there's this great build-up and excitement, and they rehearsed on Monday, and they can't wait to rehearse again on Thursday. There's a real sense of anticipation on the part of the instrumentalist that something great's happening here. And get your tickets, because their friends are going to get your tickets if you don't get your tickets.
It's great because that's the enthusiasm of the students, and it's infectious. But I think that this particular production it's just this wonderful meeting of the school and the festival, mm-hmm. Because you know, Tammy and I were both students here, are both alums of AOTC, the Aspen Opera Theater Center. I don't know if any of you have gone to the Saturday morning master classes, but Tammy and I knew them well. And it's just it's a wonderful thing, and it's worth celebrating right now that two students who were handpicked by this man have kind of come up to be able to sing here, what's our dream, you know, to sing.
I would not have thought that I'd be here right now.
Me neither. No, you know.
Fear de Ligi. Aida.
Yes. Yeah.
Same thing.
But it's a wonderful, wonderful meeting of the student, you know, the school directly feeding into the festival. And that's worth celebrating, I think.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Did you want to say it?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but now that I've been working out in the professional world for a while, you know, the Met Orchestras play at AIDA a billion times. They know it like the back of their hand. And there's something to be said for that in the fact that everybody knows it and it's precise. But for me, student orchestras, there's something so amazing about it. And I felt this way through college and grad school. People are exploring their musical language in their youth. And that comes across in these performances. And there are definitely moments where you sit there and you go, that is so amazing. And it's a different language. And I don't know, I just really enjoy student orchestra.
Well, that leads very nicely to the fact that both with Robert and with Ed working with our students, we call them students, they refer to them in their own way as artists. And Ed's approach to the singers are as a group or individually as artists, and Robert's approach to the students, my word, our word, but it's as artists who have something to contribute. Mm. And I remember when Brian sang Angelotti when we did Tosca.
Yes.
And it was really a very special moment, really, because it was one of our own students, you know, along with these professionals. And we have two wonderful such young artists, mm-hmm. and soon to be joining you and leaving the student mantle, Purim Joe as the High Priestess, and Matthew Lawden as the Messenger. Is it?
Landon Shaw.
Landon Shaw. Okay, well, I got his name wildly confused. But they're wonderful, and they really hold the stage in their moment. Purim is singing her prayer. When you and Mr. Radames are singing away, and she's holding her own absolutely through the scene.
Yeah,
she sounds
beautiful.
Terrific. And it's
also... And I did that role first at HGO. That was my intro to AIDA.
There you go.
It was the little behind the stage.
Brian Amell was also in Tosca with me. He was a Sharone. Brian Amell.
Yeah, and all of you have been wonderful because you've embraced them as a colleague,
of course.
It's terrific.
We were there eight years ago.
Yeah. Not that long ago.
So, Robert, before we turn this to questions, I want to ask you and Ed this question. Have we left anything out of our discussion that you might want to share with the public about why we're doing AIDA and how we're doing AIDA and anything that might help them enjoy the experience from the inside?
Well, I think the ground has been covered in a way, but for us, the excitement of doing opera in the tent is part of it. And also this whole idea of the multiple levels of experience around this work that are present, because in the orchestra are two members of the Met Orchestra.
Oh, fantastic.
And then there are faculty who are playing it for the first time, because their experience is largely symphonic. There are faculty whose experience is largely symphonic who are playing it for the second or third time, as opposed to the 117th time with the Met Orchestra players. We have this range of students involved. Some of the students clearly know the opera and already love it. Some of them are figuring out what they're experiencing for the first time in rehearsals. So we have the whole gamut of experience present, which I think makes it very special, not only to have opera in the tent, which inherently is special and exciting and just a wonderful venue. The tent is a great place for voices, and because of Mr. Berkeley's genius, he finds these incredible things to do with the space itself. And I think all of that adds up to an event and the sense of event that makes it, in the context of the festival, something not to be missed.
Ed, do you want to also? No, you don't want to.
I like that you raised it to silently not.
No, okay. It's great. I mean,
well, we'll open it up to questions. Because this is being recorded for radio, please use the microphone to ask a question.
I'm curious if AIDA has ever been done set in a different time and place.
It actually has, yeah. Francesca Zambello has done it with the Middle East, right?
Yep, she did that last year, actually, two years ago. Yeah.
Where it's Americans and Middle Eastern, yeah. So it's been updated a few times.
It was Rodimus, was water tortured or something like that.
Yeah.
And in Europe, I'm certain, like, it was probably set on the Sonny and Cher show.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, in Reggie Theater. Theater Magdeburg.
Okay. Only nice things if you're going to mention other people's names.
Do students come here wanting to become opera members of opera orchestras as a specialty? Is that possible?
Some do. They're not in a majority by any means, which means that's why I'm aware of them, because they've voiced their interest. And in fact, one violinist has been trying to play every opera possible this summer, which means three in the Wheeler and one on stage. So some very much have that as a passion.
My question is the size of the orchestra. So when you're doing an opera production in a theater, in a pit, I'm assuming that the size of the pit is confining the size of the orchestra. So with the ability to be in the tent on a large stage, are you taking a much larger orchestra into the production, or is it more or less the same size that would be in a normal production?
The orchestra that we're using for this would be typical in a normal, I'm saying normal, in a normal-sized house pit. The Wheeler is a very small pit, and so we often use reductions for larger works or commission reductions for larger works that require a larger orchestra. If we ever do the Ring in the Wheeler...
Yes, we need to.
We'll need to reduce the orchestra. So essentially what the tent is allowing us to do is to use the same size orchestra that one might expect in a larger house.
Okay. There's a question up here and the question back there.
This is a to whom it may concern question. What do you think was most challenging to Verdi when he was actually writing and putting the opera together?
I think a very good libretto. Can I take a stab at that? He was sent the treatment of the subject by, this is a very interesting story actually, and our annotator handles it very well. He was sent a treatment once and he declined. And they waited and they sent it again. These are Egyptian concerns who sent it to him. And the second time they upped the money. And he accepted.
It read better.
And both Philippa, Matz, and other Verdi scholars have determined that this was actually written, the treatment, not the libretto, but the treatment was written by a Verdi rival with whom he fell out a decade or more over a soprano. The issue, you can read about that in a wonderful book called Encounters with Verdi. But getting back to the subject matter, so this person remained anonymous so that Verdi wouldn't turn down the project. So eventually Verdi chose a collaborator to put it into verse, and that collaborator is named as the librettist of the opera. But it had various contributors along the way. It was a very good question. There's one right back there.
So as one of the most well-known and most produced operas around, when you approach putting it on, like you are going to do on Friday, you approach it from the standpoint of, let's make it really, really good. Or do you approach it from the standpoint of, let's make it fresh and unique and let it stand out in some way for any of you?
I hope it's always good, but...
Yes, you do both. I think that, you know, anytime we as artists are repeating roles for, you know, consecutive times, several times, you have to approach it differently. You have to, I mean, you're bringing different experiences to it. You're bringing different technical experiences to it. And it has to be fresh. I mean, we have to go with the perception that this is the first time this is being presented, you know, so that you don't fall into a rut.
And every artist has a different idea of how their role should be. And it's exciting to when you meet a new artist and they have an idea and you're like, oh, I like that. I'll play off of that. So I feel like while the material is always there, it's always the same, there's always an element of freshness, at least on our part, that we hope that we're doing. When you're doing the same production over and over, yeah, that can get kind of stale. But I think for concert, it's easier.
Yeah, and the chemistry, you never know what the chemistry is going to be between
singers. Yeah, because these people are horrible.
That's why I'm sitting over here and they're over there.
Okay. You know, collaborating together and collaborating with the director, collaborating with the conductor, there's chemistry going all different ways. You never know how it's going to
And a lot of us know each other.
And a lot of us know
each
other,
yeah. We've worked before, and...
Yeah.
Well, this Friday night, there's a lot of chemistry coming out of all these folks and others who are not here at this session. I want to take 1 minute out before I thank my guests to make an unabashed advertisement. Friday night, AIDA, 7:30. Saturday morning, 10 o'clock, Opera Scenes Masterclass at the Wheeler. Berkeley, Nicholas McGeegan, and the ACCA Orchestra with the wonderful AOTC singers and the ACCA conductors, and much more opera. Cozy is around the corner. Get your tickets. It's fabulous. And I want to thank our AIDA, Tamara Wilson, Brian Mulligan, our Amanosro, and Morris Robinson, our Ramphis, Mr. Spano, our music director and conductor, and Ed Berkeley, our director in general and at large. Thank you all.